Evergreen Sermons Online in Pastor Michael Gabbert's Wednesday night series on the book of Revelation. This message is from February 10th, 2016.
In Revelation chapter 12, you've heard me say as we've gone through the book of Revelation that I try and take things literally until I run across something that is clearly a symbol. And you say, well, how do you always know what's literal and what's a symbol? Well, because a symbol is only effective as a symbol if it's obvious to the readers that it's related to something, or if you're told that this is a symbol. And so, except in those instances, you try and take this book, that's been my sort of guiding hermeneutical principle all along. And so I take it literally wherever I can take it literally. If there's a number or a description of an event, unless there's some reason to jump to a symbol, we leave it there. We come to chapter 12, and remember how we've tried to frame this. Revelation confuses people because they read 22 chapters as though it's one single chronological telling of an event. And when you can break it down and be careful to distinguish between the unfolding chronology, the sequence of events, and see that they are periodically interrupted with a parenthesis or a sidebar. That is, the sequence is broken as though God says, okay, let's go over here and just get some information, and then we come back to the sequence, but the information allows us to flesh out the sequence of events. So we saw the seven seals. The Lamb takes the scroll that is closed, and he's worthy to open the scroll, and he breaks the first six seals, and there are a series of events that jump off the page. The four horsemen of the apocalypse, the persecution of the martyrdom of the church, and the cosmic disturbances. And then there was an interruption. There was a parenthesis that we saw in chapter 7. And then we picked it up in chapter 8 and 9 with the seventh seal, which unfolds itself as seven trumpets. But we only did six trumpets. And then there's an interruption. And that is chapter 10 through the first 14 verses of chapter 11. And it's been a while since I've taught. A couple of weeks. Let me get my tongue in motion. That's where we saw the two witnesses. That's where we get some information that informs the sequence. Then what you finished with last week was the last verses of chapter 11 is the seventh trumpet. Now, immediately we have another break. The seventh trumpet, in the same way that the seventh seal unfolded in seven trumpets, the seventh trumpet will unfold in seven bowl judgments, or judgments that are poured out from bowls. But that's not till chapter 16. So we have a long, extended section from chapter 12 through 15 that is not chronological. It's not a part of the sequence. It's a variety of insights that God gives to John to give to us to help flesh out the sequence. So we finished the seven trumpets. The seventh trumpet will become the seven bowls. But we've got some things that we need to know before then. So we come to chapter 12. Chapter 12 is... what's the title that I put on this? The History of Redemption? What's the title on the top of your page? Okay. This chapter is going to give us some information that we frankly need to interpret the entire rest of the book of Revelation. But We're told explicitly, there's a Greek word for signs here, we're told explicitly that the story of redemption is going to be relayed in chapter 12 in symbols. So here, we're not trying to hold on to the literalness of the text. Here, we've been told these are symbols. So, when we come to chapter 12, we read the verses, and it is incumbent upon us to figure out what each symbol is related to. Now, I'm going to show you the internal clues so that we have a good handle on an explanation. Oh, thank you. It really has been a while since I taught. I didn't get a microphone. I didn't get an outline. Redemption, History, and Symbols. That's a pretty good title. So we're going to find out what these symbols in chapter 12 mean, and this is going to do exactly what God meant for it to do. It's going to give us a template by which we can now, because we know what the symbols are, it helps put flesh to the skeleton of the sequence of events that will unfold through the rest of the book. Okay? So, let's go to chapter 12, and I've called the first point a cosmic Christmas, simply because of the imagery that you'll see here. It's not necessarily a Christmas story, but that was kind of catchy in my head. It sounded better in my head than I think it is in real life. But let's just look at the first verses and see if we can. There are three major symbols in these first six verses, and we've got to get this right, because that's going to play out our understanding of the rest of the book. So, Revelation chapter 12, beginning in verse 1. A great sign appeared in heaven. Now, this introduction is John saying, okay, we're no longer looking at a vision of actual events that will unfold. Somehow, against the backdrop of heaven, John is allowed to see what turns out to be the history of redemption, but he tells us up front that it's done in symbols. This word sign, and not just any sign, but a great sign. The Greek here means exactly what we mean by the word sign. It means I saw some things intended to represent other things against the backdrop of heaven. Okay? A woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet and a crown of 12 stars on her head. Now see, if that's literal, then we've got real issues. Clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in labor and agony as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven. There was a great fiery red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his heads were 7 diadems or jewels, or more loosely translated, 7 crowns. His tail swept away a third of the stars in heaven and hurled them to the earth. And the dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she did give birth, he might devour her child. But she gave birth to a son, a male, who is going to shepherd all nations with an iron scepter. And her child was caught up to God and to his throne. The woman fled into the wilderness, where she had a place prepared by God to be fed there for 1,260 days. Now, this is the very kind of paragraph in the book of Revelation that causes people who don't understand the book to sort of write it off as bizarre mythology or some kind of crazy mythological tale. Because right here we've got a woman who's expecting a child, but she's clothed in celestial bodies, the sun, the moon, the stars. And she's approached by a fiery red dragon. Okay, right there, the average reader, with no understanding of this chapter, they've just gone, oh, what I tell you, you can't make sense of this. This is ridiculous. What? Do people really believe this stuff? Okay. That's why John said, I saw a sign. I saw a symbol. A woman. The woman is a symbol. I saw another symbol, another sign, a fiery red dragon. In the last days, in the final events of redemption history, we're not having a red dragon with a tail breathing fire that's going to show up on the scene. It's a symbol. What's it a symbol of? Well, that's fine. In these first three verses, there are three personages that have to be identified. The woman who's pregnant, an expectant woman, the red dragon, and the newborn baby boy. Verse 1 and 2 are related to the woman. She's clothed with the sun, the moon under her feet, a crown of stars, 12 stars on her head, pregnant, cried out in labor and agony. She was about to give birth. This is a vision, and it has been interpreted in really three primary ways over the last 2,000 years of Christian history. The Roman Catholic Church interprets this symbol as the Virgin Mary. They like that because it plays into a Mariolatry, a worship of Mary that really developed several hundred years after the New Testament period. The idea that Mary is almost a part of the Godhead, this plays into that because you have this woman described in these celestial terms. I mean, she's clothed with the sun. The moon, in a sense, is her footstool. She's surrounded by a crown of 12 stars. See, there's an image there of this woman that has this remarkable framework of description. And so the Roman Catholic Church has interpreted this as Mary. The problem with that, it really involves a lot of different things. First of all, Mary, in no place in the entire Bible, is presented in these kinds of glorious terms. Mary was a simple, obedient servant of the Lord. She was humble, she was available, she was faithful. Every time we see her, whether it's receiving the announcement of a virgin birth from an angel and pondering in her heart the awesomeness that God has chosen her for this extraordinary opportunity, or if it's the Mary at the end of the life of Jesus who's standing at the foot of the cross being comforted by those around her while she's in a sense you get the picture that while they're trying to comfort her as the mother of this son that is hanging on the cross, there's a confidence in her that really is producing a comfort for the rest of those that are with her. But you never see Mary described in these kind of terms. And really it's an awkward picture of this very simple woman. Now, another interpretation is that this woman who is clearly giving birth to a significant son is the church. Now, we have already laid out a scenario where the church has been raptured. And so in the chronology of Revelation, the church is not really a part of any of the events that we've seen so far. But you might be able to make the case that this is an interruption to the sequence of events. This is an informational thing. This could be sort of the backstory of the church. Here's the problem. In no place in the New Testament is the church ever seen producing Jesus Christ. Christ is never born out of the church. In fact, it's just the opposite. The church is born from Christ. I mean, the church is birthed after the ascension. So there's no real fit here for the church being this woman who is clearly going to produce a male son that we'll see to be the Messiah. So there's one other interpretation that makes sense of the text, and that is this woman is a symbol for the nation of Israel. Now, this whole episode in these first two verses is really, I've called it a cosmic Christmas because it is an apocalyptic flashback, a vision of the birth of Jesus from heaven's perspective. That is, while Mary was the particular and specific mother of Jesus, from the heavenly perspective, watching not just the events in Bethlehem with the shepherds and the wise men and the manger, Mary and Joseph, those parts of the Christmas story that we're most familiar with, from heaven's perspective, that moment in time, what Paul calls the fullness of time when God became flesh and dwelt among us, from heaven's perspective, they saw so much more happening than only the simple manger scene, the nativity that we all have in our own minds about Christmas. From heaven's perspective, what was happening here is that Mary was the particular mother of Jesus, but heaven saw the birth of the Messiah as flowing out of God's work through His people Israel. This woman, described as a symbol in chapter 12, must be a representative picture of the nation of Israel. Now this view, this cosmic view of Christmas, was unseen in Bethlehem, but certainly it's not a stretch to know that that night had to hold cosmic significance. Even the eventual attack of Herod and his that's some of the image that you have here. This idea of a dragon waiting to devour the baby as soon as he's born. I mean, from a human perspective, we can say, well, that's loosely connected to Herod and his slaughter of the innocents when the wise men alert him to the fact that there's a king that's been born in Bethlehem. But see, even as in so much of prophecy, the earthly events are merely physical manifestations of the invisible events that are really going on all around. Herod, like the Antichrist to come, was a man whose actions were motivated, even energized, by the enemy of God. But frankly, Herod's not smart enough to play out this story. He's compelled to participate in a drama that again, from heaven's perspective, is obvious and not invisible. That is, there is one who stands in such opposition to God that when he sees the coming of this one that had been prophesied, this God becoming flesh, his goal was to frustrate that. Now, let's go ahead and talk about the dragon, because this plays out altogether. Verse 3, another sign appeared in heaven. There was a great fiery red dragon, 7 heads, 10 horns. On his heads were 7 diadems. His tail swept away 1/3 of the stars in heaven and hurled them to the earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that when she did give birth, he might devour her child. All right, here again, if we try and take this literally, we've not only got a fiery red dragon, but it's bizarrely a dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and these are symbolic references. The heads represent wisdom, intelligence. The horns represent power. And what we have here is an enemy who, like a brute beast, is frothing at the mouth in his efforts to defeat the unfolding drama of redemption. This may play into some of the reasons why we get in mythology this idea of the devil with horns and tail and such. It's this dragon imagery, but there's nothing literal here. It's a picture. Red is the color of blood. Fiery it's not so much the word related to flame as much as it is the word related to feistiness, like anger. This is a red, fiery dragon, meaning this is a bloodthirsty, passionate enemy who is lusting for the destruction of the one that he hates. Now let's just do a little background on the dragon, because the dragon imagery is going to be played out in coming chapters when we see sort of an unholy trinity. We know the Trinity is the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And we're going to have the dragon and then the beast, who is the Antichrist, and then the false prophet. And Satan, he has no creativity. He has no imagination. He lost any any sense of that when he rebelled against the Father and sort of rejected his place. But he's a counterfeiter. And so that's what he'll try and do in coming chapters. But I want you to, let's just read some of the verses. We don't often wander away from Revelation, but I want you to hear a couple of verses. I've mentioned before, Isaiah chapter 14 and Ezekiel chapter 28 are sections in the Old Testament that are associated with the kings of Tyre and of Babylon. And they describe those kings in terms of their arrogance, their rebellion against God. But even if you allow for poetic license, the language of those chapters is really over the top if you just connect it to earthly kings. Again, in the same way that we can look at Herod and say that Herod was an earthly king, but from the heavens perspective, he was motivated, he was energized by an evil force, an evil personage that used Herod as a tool. In the same way, in these chapters, Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28, we have the king of Tyre and the king of Babylon, who are arrogant, who are full of themselves, and yet the language here that talks about their determination to take the place of God and being cast out of heaven, the language, even with poetic license, is too over the top to just be these human kings. In a sense, they're just the representation of a greater reality that's behind them, a motivating factor. And so in those Old Testament passages, you have these hints of a pre-cosmic encounter in heaven where there was an angel by the name of Lucifer, son of the morning, who was beautiful by all accounts, one of the finest created beings in the cosmos, and yet out of his own unwillingness to serve at the pleasure of the one who sits on the throne, he asserted himself. He made a claim to a position that did not belong to him. In fact, his persuasiveness, we're told, brought a third of the angels into his camp. And they're actually in a sort of pre-cosmic battle. Some of them are banished and literally chained up. We've seen the hints in Revelation of a place where some angels have been locked away since that pre-cosmic event until a time where God will allow them, like a black plague of locusts, to emerge from the abyss and become a torturous presence on the earth as an instrument of judgment in the hands of God. See, some of them are locked away and have been since before the days of creation. Others were allowed. They're useful in the unfolding drama. Satan comes and goes. We have that mysterious passage in the book of Job where he actually stands in the court of heaven as an accuser of the brothers. Listen, don't ask me to explain all the ins and outs of a world that we're not given. I mean, I've just shared with you most of the information that we have. We're not told everything, but there are, besides those two Old Testament references, there are a couple of New Testament references that you'll be interested in. One is in 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4, speaking about God's judgment on false teachers. Peter says in verse 4 of chapter 2, "For if God didn't spare the angels who sinned but threw them down into Tartarus," which is a different word for the abyss, "He threw them down into Tartarus and delivered them to be kept in chains of darkness until judgment." He goes on to say, if God didn't spare the ancient world but protected Noah, if he reduced the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to ashes, he's giving a litany of events, basically saying that God picks his time, God picks his timetable, but at periodic moments along the way, God has always issued judgment on rebellion. But the very first example he uses before we get to the generation of Noah or Sodom and Gomorrah or any of those other examples, he starts with a pre-cosmic event where God judged the rebellion of angels by locking them away in the abyss. Well, one more verse. Look at Jude. Just a couple of pages over from 2 Peter. Jude verse 6. Well, let's start with verse 5. Jude says, "Now I want to remind you, though you know all these things, the Lord first saved the people out of Egypt and later destroyed those who did not believe. And he has kept with eternal chains in darkness for the judgment of the great day the angels who did not keep their own position but deserted their proper dwelling." He's referring to the same mysterious pre-cosmic event that God locked away some of the rebellious angels and has reserved them as an instrument of wrath on the earth in the final days when he releases them and they flood out like a plume of black smoke that takes the shape of locusts and becomes a spiritually oppressive torture on those that are against God. Well, Satan, at least in this sequence of events, he's not been given that name yet. We're going to see it show up in just a minute. But Satan, his name was Lucifer. It means son of the morning star. But he's given the name Satan, which means the adversary. And he becomes the driving force of all that stands in opposition to God for all time and space. Well, what do we have in this story so far? We have a symbol of the chosen people of God. God called Abraham out of a far country. He brought him to a land and said, "I'm going to give you this land. The family that will become a nation will be a blessing to all the peoples of the earth." And literally, it's the idea that out of the people of God, God uses Israel to birth the Messiah. But there is one who has been in opposition to God since before creation. And he knows that to destroy this child, to do damage to this so-called Messiah, this anointed one, is to short-circuit the whole plan, start to finish. I wish we could follow this train of thought and just explore it with our sanctified imagination. I mean, I see in my mind's eye the demons who've continuously scouted the earth, who come to Satan and said, "We found him. There's this one Jesus, and he's the one born in that manger, and he's just been baptized by one named John, and the secret is out because when he came up out of the waters of baptism, a voice came from heaven and said, 'This is my son in whom I am well pleased. This is the one. This is who we've been waiting for. It's been confirmed.'" Satan immediately takes off to encounter this one that he's been waiting for. Well, what happens? Matthew chapter 3, the baptism of Jesus. Matthew chapter 4, the temptation by Satan. You see, the goal is, if he can mess up this perfect life, if he can, through temptation, lead this one to sin, like he did that first Adam so long ago, redemption falls through. The drama breaks down. And so he comes to him and he says, "Listen, people are saying you're the Son of God. Why don't you turn one of these stones into bread and just prove yourself?" Jesus says, "You know, it's the bread of the Word of God that provides my sustenance." He takes him up to the pinnacle of the temple and he says, "Look at all these people down here. I mean, if you're so special, why don't you just jump off? Take a head first plunge and let the angels, we can see them, but the people can't see them. There are angels everywhere. Let those angels swoop down and save you from death. Show yourself for who you are." Just said, no, that's not how we do this. I follow the plan that the Father's put into place. Satan takes him to a place where he shows him all the kingdoms of the earth. And he says, bow down to me. I'll give you a thing, the root of the world. No cross, no execution, no flogging, no beating, no anger and hatred. You just bow down to me, and I'll give it all to you. See, what was he doing? Everywhere along the way, from the Garden of Eden, when Satan said, I failed in my rebellion against the one who sits on the throne. He had a third of the angels. He tried to take over heaven. He couldn't do it. So what's his next plan? I'll destroy the intentions, the plan, the redemption. This is a symbol of that. In this story of this fiery red dragon posed to swallow up this child as soon as it's born, we have a picture of this opposition, an effort to defeat redemption. We see it in the Garden of Eden. We see it with the generation that created so much sin that it required God to send a flood on the earth and to, in a sense, almost start fresh. We see it in the cross, the heavenly battle of angels. We see it in the martyrdom of the church. Every generation has had those places where men, motivated by this implacable enemy to the one who sits on the throne, he can't get to God. So he's tried to destroy his children. First, the Son. And then by extension, his sons and daughters. That's what's unfolding here. Look at where this goes. The church has to understand that Satan's constant positioning throughout history has been to try and thwart God's purposes of redemption. Verse 5, we've got, she gave birth to the Son. Israel produced the promised Messiah. It was a male who was going to shepherd all nations with an iron scepter. That's interesting. Iron scepter is a word of political authority. It's the tool of a king, and yet he's described as a shepherd. This is a king who has the authority over all of the earth, but he has the loving care of a pastor, of a shepherd for all the nations. And her child was caught up to God and to his throne. The woman fled into the wilderness where she had a place prepared by God to be fed there for 1260 days. Now here's the interesting thing. In order to interpret Revelation, you have to get a handle on the story that's being told in the moment. Because here we have this child who is born a product of Israel, opposed by Satan. No sooner is he born than he's caught up into heaven. It's actually the same word that's used to describe the church being caught up in a twinkling of an eye. It's a word that Paul used in the book of Thessalonians. It's basically a word that means rapture, but what they're talking about is the ascension of Jesus. You say, well, wait, he was just born and now he's being ascended. Okay, here's how apocalyptic literature works. In just a few verses, he's unfolding the history of redemption. The woman, the chosen people, produces the Messiah. At every step of the way, the enemy has tried to frustrate those plans of God. The child is born and he's caught up into heaven. They're bookmarks. The whole life and ministry of Jesus is bracketed by his supernatural birth, his incarnation, God becoming flesh, and his ascension when he takes his place at the right hand of God. It includes a sinless life. It includes a Palm Sunday entry into Jerusalem. It includes a crucifixion, 3 days in a tomb, a resurrection, 40 days of appearances. It's all here, but in the story, what he's unfolding the whole history. So in this moment, he has his birth and his ascension. And then he says, then the woman is carried to a place in the wilderness where she's protected for 1,260 days. What is that? 3.5 years. What we've done in the space of just a few Greek words is we've gone the full spectrum from a pre-cosmic battle to physical creation, the fall of man into sin, the unfolding of the entire Old Testament so that Israel produces a Messiah, the life, death, burial, resurrection, appearance, and ascension of the Messiah to the right hand of God, and then flash forward to the last 3.5 years of the tribulation. See, now wait a minute. So you're telling me between verse 5 and verse 6, there's 2,000 and something years. That's exactly what I'm telling you. Why? It's like if you took a class in 19th century American history, but the class chose not to cover the Civil War, because there's a whole separate class just about the Civil War. You see, what he's done here is he's telling the story of redemption from the perspective of God's people Israel. The 2,000 plus years of what were called the times of the Gentiles or the church age, they're not mentioned here, not because they're not significant, but because that portion of the story is finished. The church has been raptured. They're watching this unfold. He's reviewing this redemption history through the chosen people. And when Jesus ascends to heaven, the next thing of significance is this moment of judgment in the last 3.5 years when God is going to bring his people back to himself. They will find, the people who rejected the Messiah will find the Messiah. But something interesting is going to happen. The opposition that can't get to the one who's seated on the throne and who now can't get to this newborn baby boy, this opposition goes after what's left. The chosen people of God. You know, it really boggles the mind to consider the reality of anti-Semitism in the 21st century. I mean, I want you to think about this. First of all, it's a miracle that a people called the Jews still exist and have a distinct identity. I mean, no other ancient tribe of people is still around. You don't know any Amalekites. You don't know any Hittites. There's not a community in central Ohio of, you know, Assyrians. I mean, we don't have any of the, all those ancient people groups have disappeared. They've blended, they've merged, they've assimilated. It's only the Jews that have this multi-millennial history and still have a coherent identity as a particular group of people. I mean, if you took every Jewish person alive on the planet today, we've got to be talking about a fraction of a fraction of a percent of the global population. I mean, it would be minuscule. Plus, not to mention the fact that they live on a parcel of land in the middle of the desert that's about as unattractive a homeland as any place on earth. I mean, they're surrounded by nations filthy rich with oil money, and yet, at least until today, there have been no hugely significant oil reserves discovered in Israel. There are no precious metals or precious gem mines. About the only thing Israel produces that it exports is potash, which is kind of an element that goes into the making of other things. It's not a particularly attractive piece of property. It's minute. in actual geographical space. So why does everybody in the world have this bee in their bonnet about the Israel, about Israel? I mean, like 9 out of every 10 United Nations pronouncements are chastising Israel for something. I mean, they take a beating in political realms, there are nations that hate them. There is an anti-Semitism that is vastly out of proportion for the population size and the geographical spread of this little bitty nation. Doesn't make any sense at all. It's bizarre. How do you explain it? It only makes sense if there's a supernatural enemy that has so invigorated a hatred within the human race against the people of God. Now, is every Jewish person going to heaven? No. Clearly, we're going to see that God, through the tribulation, preserves a remnant. It's not just being born Jewish that's the deal here, but it is this people group that God has chosen to use to unfold redemption for the whole world. That's why they're so hated. There is an invisible opposition behind everything from the United Nations to terrorists to all of the stuff that goes on nowadays, including increasingly the United States of America. And here's the thing. If you believe the Bible, most of the positions held by most of the people on this planet right now are going to put them on the wrong side of history when God finishes His story. This verse 6, it's in the last 3.5 years. Somehow, Israel is physically relocated to a place of protection in the wilderness. Doesn't tell us any more than that. We just know that there is a sort of temporary security in the first 3.5 years because the Antichrist will make a covenant of peace. Israel will flourish, but at the midpoint, the Antichrist will break the treaty. He'll defile the temple that they've been allowed to rebuild, and he will begin to persecute them. And in some mysterious way, all we're told is that as God has done at times throughout history, He will physically put His people in a place of protection and safety, even as the whole world is attempting to destroy them. Now, the church is not here. We're talking about Israel. We're talking about the Jews. Now, 7:19. Okay, so we get a split screen, that's the way I've described it in the rest of this chapter, as these symbols are going to continue to play out. This is not chronological to where we are in Revelation. This is just information that we're being given to make sense of the big picture, and we're going to see how this informs what's still to come in Revelation. Look at verse 7. This is the split screen I've called War in Heaven, the dragon thrown out of heaven. Then war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. The dragon and his angels also fought, but he could not prevail, and there was no place for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was thrown out, the ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan. See, now here's where the name comes in. He's called by a number of different names throughout the Bible. Lucifer was sort of his created name, and that name has come to be, have negative connotations to us. But originally Lucifer, like Gabriel or Michael, he was an angel of some renown in the structure, the pecking order, if you will, of how God created angels. Devil is a word that means opposition, evil. Satan is a word that means adversary. He's called the accuser of the brothers because, frankly, that's his favorite strategy. The whole book of Job is based on the premise that God is proud of Job, and what does Satan do? He says, Job just worships you because you give him blessings. I mean, you take away the blessings, he'll curse you to your face. What's he doing? Both through half-truths and untruths, he accuses the brothers. He demeans the integrity of the faith of God's people. That's what he does. The ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the one who deceives the whole world, he was thrown to earth and his angels with him. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah have now come, because the accuser of our brothers has been thrown out, the one who accuses them before our God day and night. They conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they did not love their lives in the face of death. Therefore, rejoice, you heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you with great fury, because he knows he has a short time. Now, there are some people who say this section of Revelation is a recap of the Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28 versions of a pre-cosmic battle. I don't think that's what's happening here. I think that there is in this process immediately, remember, we haven't finished all of the judgments yet, but we're just getting information that will inform what's still to come. Israel, in the last 3.5 years, is physically and supernaturally protected from this enemy. But this same enemy is thrown out of heaven. Now, how is the devil in heaven? That always throws us for a loop. But we know from Job this sense that Satan, even though he is out of favor, because he is, in a sense, useful, he's allowed to come and go. But there is a time in the last days when Michael initiates a confrontation that eventually has the devil and his followers swept out of heaven once and for all permanently. There's great, I call it victory of angels. That's these first verses. The last gasp of Satan's hostility in heaven is foiled by Michael and the army of angels. He's lost his opportunity to fulfill this plan of insurrection that started before creation. This really is the beginning of the end. They celebrate in heaven that he's gone. There are regular outbursts of praise throughout the book of Revelation. But in this section, those verses, verse 10 and verse 11, are really critical verses to the whole book of Revelation. Because John says, when he sees him thrown out of heaven, he says, I heard a loud voice in heaven say this. And what he said was, he refers to the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God. That word power is an interesting Greek word. It means the irresistible omnipotence of God. That is a power that cannot be withstood. But that is coupled with the authority of his Messiah. Authority means, is a word that points to the propriety of Christ as the ruler of the universe. It says they are celebrating because the accuser of our brothers. See, who's giving this praise? Probably the church. They're probably the ones singing this. Because the accuser of our brothers has been thrown out, the one who accuses them before our God day and night. Now, speaking about our brothers, these are martyrs, okay? He says they conquered him. This is a powerful verse. They conquered him by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of their testimony, for they did not love their lives in the face of death. This is an absolutely incredible verse, and it ought to be memorized by every follower of Jesus Christ. It tells us a couple of things. It tells us that the only adequate tool for doing spiritual battle with the enemy of God's people is the blood of Jesus Christ. But it's not enough to just believe in the blood. See where it says the word of their testimony? That is the confession of their life, that blood has been applied to their souls. Even when they lost their lives, even when they went from being saints to being martyrs, they win. Why? Because from the moment Satan set foot in the Garden of Eden, his single purpose has been to frustrate the plan of God to create a people who would be eternally in relationship with him, an object of his full love, created in his image, living in that relationship. Satan's been trying to break that down from day one. And there is a day coming, and it's in the last days of the tribulation, when the song in heaven will be, "We won." Because we're covered by the blood of the Lamb. And the testimony, the word of our testimony, is the faithfulness of our lives. We win. Now here's the split screen. That's the celebration in heaven, because Satan's been tossed. And he's gone. He'll never set foot in heaven again. Not one single time. But he's not yet locked away. He's been exiled where? To the earth. And the rage of his defeat leads the writer to say, "Woe to the earth and the sea." Look at how it ends. "Woe to the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you with great fury." Why? Because he knows he has a short time. Listen, even in those last moments when the battle is settled, I mean, he's thrashing about, he knows he's defeated. He knows he's lost. But you're not going to find this bitter, angry, hate-filled being bowing his knee to God in repentance. He's going to go all the way to the bottom. Why? Because he crossed the line of rejecting submission to the one who sits on the throne a long time ago. Look what happens on the earth. These are the closing verses. "When the dragon saw that he had been thrown to earth," what does he do? He can't get to God, the one who sits on the throne. He can't get to the Son, the Messiah. He can't even get to the bride of Christ, who is now had taken their places in heaven. Who's left? The remnant of the people of God who have come back to their Messiah, found their faith, and they're living out the final days of this tribulation. "He persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child." He persecutes Israel. Listen, we haven't seen anything, not in Hitler's Third Reich, not in Stalin, not in any of the anti-Semitic dictators in human history. We haven't seen anything like what will happen in the last years of the tribulation. "The woman was given two wings of a great eagle so that she could fly from the serpent's presence to her place in the wilderness, where she was fed for a time, times, and half a time." 3.5 years. We've seen that language used before. "From his mouth the serpent spewed water." Now remember, these are symbols. This whole chapter, these are symbols. "From his mouth the serpent spewed water like a river flowing after the woman to sweep her away in a torrent." Now, it's not suggesting that in the middle of the desert there will be a flash flood, but it is this idea that he will pursue her and use any means possible to try and sweep her away to destruction. "But the earth helped the woman. The earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the river that the dragon had spewed from its mouth. So the dragon was furious with the woman and left to wage war against the rest of her offspring." Get this. "Those who keep God's commands and have the testimony about Jesus." He stood on the sand of the sea. Okay, don't miss this. The woman is Israel. Her primary offspring is the Messiah. Can't get to the Messiah. Can't get to the one who sits on the throne. Now, because of supernatural protection, he can't get to the woman. He can't get to Israel. So he leaves to go after the rest of her offspring. Who is this? Tribulation saints who have discovered their Messiah, given their lives to Jesus, and followed him. The last bastion of devilish opposition on the earth is to lash out against those tribulation saints, those who entered the tribulation because they were not of the people of God, but found their Messiah and became, like Peter tells us, even for us, we were once not a people of God, but we were made a people of God when the blood washed over us and made us clean. Listen, chapter 12 tells us some things that we need to know. We need to know that the dragon, the energizing force behind all of the opposition against the people of God through the rest of the story, it is that very one, the devil, Satan, the accuser of the brothers, whatever name he goes by at the moment, that's the dragon. He's behind it all. The woman is not Mary, it's not the church, it is Israel. Israel produces a son who is the Messiah. These pieces, these symbols, are important for us to understand because it explains everything that's happened in redemption history. It explains why Satan stepped into the garden and introduced sin into human history. It explains why God chose Abraham to create a special people to be the vehicle of redemption and produce the Messiah. It explains the opposition of Satan all the way through the Old Testament and his attempt to destroy the people Israel. It explains his attacks on Jesus from the time he was an infant in Bethlehem until he's being tempted in the wilderness, until he comes to the cross, until he's threatened with death itself. It explains all of that. It explains why for 2,000 years he has been after the church. He's been trying to martyr. If Satan had his way, people like us would never meet in a spot like this. He'd have our heads in a heartbeat, except God has the dog on a leash. And it explains the Antichrist that we'll see in chapter 13 and the false prophet who's the third member of this counterfeit Trinity. And it explains the final anti-Semitic burst of human history. And it explains the last gasp attempt to destroy our brothers and sisters who will be the tribulation saints. And it explains the necessity of Armageddon. And it leads us to the promise of the second coming. And it takes us to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And it walks us to a picture of home where a new heaven and a new earth descend and everything will be made right. Father, thank you for your word. What a remarkable story this is. And in just a few sentences, you revealed it to John. He shared it with us in pictures, in symbols. Father, give us clear understanding so that we might continually walk through this book, understanding completely what it is you want us to see. Thank you for this sidebar of chapter 12 and the picture from eternity past to eternity future that is painted here. Father, thank you for the guarantee of the outcome. Lord, this snake's head is already cut off. He just doesn't know it yet. Give us the faith to stand firm, to walk strong, and to defeat the enemy by the blood of the Lamb and the word of our testimony. Father, find in us a people worthy of the calling with which we've been called. This is our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen.